to welcome everyone to Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is all about highlighting the local impacts of climate change. We're going to do a wonderful update on that topic, given the wealth of resources that have been coming out recently that can help all of us as climate advocates highlight those impacts. So with that, let me just do a quick introduction to our featured speaker that will guide us through tonight's topic, and that is none other than the wonderful Dana Nucatelli. Dana is an environmental scientist, author of Climatology versus Pseudoscience. That book is featured right there. If you're interested, it's available on Amazon, I know still. Can't recommend it enough. He's published 10 papers related to climate change in peer-reviewed journals, including 3 studies on the expert climate consensus. Dana has also written for many years, really a decade, about climate scientists on the wonderful website and app, skepticalscience.com. as well as The Guardian, and now recently he's become part of the Yale Climate Communications team. You can follow him on Twitter at Dana1981. But to get us going tonight, there's really 3 learning goals that Dana is going to hopefully walk us through. And if we've done our job well, at the end of this webinar tonight, you'll walk away with a review of some of the main findings by region groups for the 4th National Climate Assessment Report. You'll know how to highlight the wealth of resources available on additional support for sharing local climate impacts in your community. And we'll also have a chance to really dig into how to share and use this information and really highlight the local impacts research with your own advocacy. To do that, our agenda is just really straightforward. We're going to have a review of the 4th National Climate Assessment. We're going to do that through the U.S. Regional Impacts chapters. We're going to highlight those local impacts by region, as well as a couple of others that Dana will throw in. And then we'll talk a bit about further examples and resources before opening it up for Q&A. So without further ado, I will pass the baton to you, Dana. Thank you all for being on the line, and we look forward to learning from you in tonight's training.
Okay. Sounds good. Hey, everybody. The 4th National Climate Assessment Report. So the National Climate Assessment Report is basically a report that Congress mandates that United States climate scientists have to write periodically, have to publish periodically, and so this is the 4th one that was just published. It actually came out the day after Thanksgiving of last year. There were probably political reasons why it was released on that particular day, but nevertheless, it was published last November, and so it's a really great resource. There are about 300 climate scientists who contribute to the report, and they all contribute their particular expertise and knowledge about various different climate impacts in different regions of the country. And so I put it on par with the IPCC report as a really valuable and credible resource to go to look at specific climate change impacts. And one really nice feature of the report is that it breaks the country up into these different regions and looks specifically at the climate impacts in each of these regions. And so it's a really good resource if you live in specifically in the Southeast, for example, and you want to talk about the impacts of climate change to the Southeast United States, and you can go to that particular chapter of the report and read what the latest climate science research says about the impacts of climate change to the Southeast. And then you can communicate that to your neighbors, and that's a really good resource because it's a good idea because people tend not to realize that climate change is already impacting us today. They tend to view it as a distant problem, a distant in time and space. It's going to hurt somebody else in the future and in another country or another region. It's not going to impact me. And so this is a good way to find out what the scientific literature says about how it's already impacting us in our regions today. So that's a really important thing to communicate to people. So to go from a large scale view, that's where I'd like to start. A lot of people tend to not understand the difference between global warming and climate change. And so I like to kind of start there. And so global warming is just increasing the average surface temperature of the Earth or the amount of heat on Earth. And then when the temperature increases due to the increased greenhouse effect, due to carbon increasing in the atmosphere, when the temperature goes up, that in turn causes various types of climate change. And so that's, you know, it's the climate changes that most impact us in various different ways. And so, for example, when temperatures are higher, it means the ocean temperatures are also higher, which in, when ocean temperatures are higher and a hurricane goes across the ocean and the temperature is high, that basically acts as hurricane fuel. And so the warming, increasing ocean temperatures in turn makes hurricanes on average stronger, or you get more strong category 3, 4, 5 hurricanes. When you get higher temperatures, you also get more ice melting, and you also get water as it warms expands. And so those two things cause sea level rise. And sea level rise has a variety of impacts, but one of those is that when you get a hurricane again going across higher ocean levels, that causes bigger storm surges, and so that causes increased, you know, flooding and damages in the wake of a hurricane. An obvious one is when you have higher temperatures, you're going to get more frequent heat waves and stronger heat waves. That's kind of just an obvious, higher temperature means worse heat waves. You get bigger wildfires because, for a few main reasons. One, because temperatures are higher, which makes things drier. And so when things are drier, it basically creates more fuel for wildfires. And then depending on the region, it can also change precipitation patterns and, again, dry things out potentially and create more wildfire fuel. And we're going to talk about that in a little more detail in a few slides from now. And then, and just in general, when you have higher temperatures, you have more evaporation. Again, that dries things out. But the atmosphere, when it's warmer, the atmosphere holds more water vapor. And so then when you get a storm, there's more water vapor available in the atmosphere. It will tend to drop more precipitation. So you get more, you get both more drier conditions, and you also get in other regions, you get more intense storms and worse flooding. So you kind of just get all these extremes due to increased temperatures causing these various types of climate change. And which type you get the most depends on which region you're in. So we're going to go through some of the regions in the United States and look at which ones are the most important to each of those regions from the Fourth National Climate Assessment primarily. And so starting in the Southeast, the big obvious one is hurricanes. That's kind of where we get a lot of those Atlantic hurricanes coming. And then so hurricanes are also impacted by sea level rise, as we mentioned. So, you know, as I already mentioned, when you get higher sea level and you get the hurricane going across the higher sea level, you get more of the, you know, more water getting pushed onto land, more storm surges, which means more flooding, which basically just means that much more damage associated with a given hurricane. And again, because when you get warmer oceans, you get stronger hurricanes, and so you're getting more of these 3, 4, 5 category hurricanes doing more damage that way because they have higher wind speed. And again, because you have more water up in the atmosphere, the hurricanes will kind of drop more precipitation, and so that adds to the flooding. And so basically hurricanes already are associated with flooding inland, but because you have more water vapor in the atmosphere and because you have higher sea levels, climate change in those ways is amplifying the amount of flooding associated with a given hurricane. So sea level rise, there's a lot of misconceptions about sea level rise. I will often hear myths that, for example, sea levels have been rising for centuries and therefore the sea level rise is just natural and it's nothing to worry about. People will say sea level isn't rising any faster than it was, you know, 100 or 200 years ago. And these are all incorrect. We have very good sea level data from tide gauges and other sources. And sea level rise, we have now, scientists have determined, is accelerating. You can see this nice chart here. It shows in the early 1900s, it was rising slowly, and then the mid-1900s, it was rising faster, and then in recent decades, rising even faster from about 1 millimeter a year to 2 millimeters a year to about 3 millimeters a year. Over the past decade, we're up to about 4 millimeters per year of sea level rise globally. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's actually quite a bit, especially since it's accelerating. That acceleration is really what we're worried about. And I mean, the reason it's accelerating is, for one thing, temperatures are going higher and we're getting a lot more melting ice. And what we're particularly worried about is these large ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica that hold a lot of ice that are sitting on land. So when those ice sheets start to collapse and the water starts to go into the ocean, that can cause a significant amount of sea level rise and a significant acceleration in sea level rise. And we're starting to see that now, and it's going to continue to happen. And so this slide shows a chart from a nice paper published a few years ago showing a few potential scenarios for sea level rise and kind of the range that we can expect to see over the next century or so up to the year 2100. So you can see there's a lot of different potential scenarios, potential outcomes here in terms of how much global sea rise we're going to see. A lot of that uncertainty is because of those big ice sheets. We don't know exactly how stable or unstable they are, how quickly they're going to kind of collapse and go into the ocean. There's big ice sheets in West Antarctica that climate scientists are pretty confident we're pretty sure that they're going to end up collapsing. And so those we know are going to cause pretty significant sea level rise over time. We just don't know how fast it's going to happen. And so that's why we have this wide range of possibilities. I think most likely we can expect to see about a meter of sea level rise by the year 2100, which is 3 feet. But potentially we could see twice that. We could see half of that. So there's really a lot of uncertainty associated with just how fast this problem will happen. There is also, of course, it depends on how much we get global warming under control. If we slow global temperature rise, then that will slow the melting of the ice and it will slow the sea level rise as well. So there's a lot of uncertainty associated with both with how we're going to act and also how the ice sheets are going to respond. So especially for the southern United States, sea level rise is a big problem. So this chart shows kind of a map of what we can expect to see around the New Orleans and Miami areas if we get 8 foot sea level rise. So that's kind of at the high end. We probably won't see that much by 2100, although it's possible we could. But you know, the world's not going to end in 2100. Sea levels are going to continue to rise as these ice sheets continue to melt. And so at some point, we will likely get to 8 foot sea level rise. And you can see from these maps, pretty much New Orleans and Miami are either underwater or, you know, you can try to build the wall around them and create a man-made island or something, but they're in pretty bad shape. Miami in particular, there was actually a really good story this week about a journalist who went to Miami and posed as a real estate buyer, and she was talking to a bunch of real estate agents in Miami and kind of posed that question to them, you know, should I be worried about sea level rise if I'm buying property in Miami? And the answers tended to be kind of, well, we've installed some pumps and we've raised a few roads and buildings. So we've got it under control, and for the next 30 to 50 years, we'll probably be fine. And then, well, what happens after 30 to 50 years? Well, then, even if it lasts that long, then, you know, it's not looking too good for Miami. So yeah, for the Southeast in particular, sea level rise is a really serious concern, especially for Southern Florida. It's at low sea levels, already seeing sunny day flooding, which is when, you know, you got sunny weather, you're not getting rain, but you're still seeing flooding from these ocean water kind of coming in from below. And because the sea level is rising, it's a really serious problem for the Southeast. And there's been some good research on previous climate eras that were similar to today's and looking at what the climate and the sea level looked at the time. And so a good comparison is it's an era called the mid-Pliocene, which was about 3 million years ago. So at that time, temperatures were pretty similar. They're about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, which is kind of what we're aiming for. 2 degrees is the Paris target. We're trying to stay below 2 degrees, but at this point, it's looking like we'll be more in that 2 to 3 degree range unless we kind of really get our act together. And so at that time, carbon dioxide was about the same as today, 400 parts per million. The scientists doing this research found they estimated that the West Antarctic ice sheet that I was talking about, that ice sheet collapsed when we got to about 3 degrees Celsius above what are pre-industrial temperatures today. And so at that time, global sea level was probably more than 50 feet higher than it is today at this climate era that had a very similar climate to where we're headed around, you know, sometime this century. And so, you know, the reason for this big difference in sea level rise is these big ice sheets slowly collapsing. It's going to take a long time. It's probably going to take, you know, centuries, maybe a millennium for these ice sheets to fully collapse. Although, again, that's a big uncertainty how fast it's going to happen. But the problem is if we stay at that temperature, then eventually we're going to get to something close to that sea level rise. That's a pretty astonishing level of sea level rise. So I personally, my takeaway from that is not only do we have to, you know, limit to the Paris targets, but eventually we're going to have to kind of pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and get temperatures down to below that level so that, you know, we can hopefully preserve some of those ice sheets. So moving on to the Midwest, a couple of the most important impacts there are flooding and heat waves. And so we've just recently been seeing the problem of flooding there with a lot of the rivers kind of overtopping and flooding a lot of areas of Nebraska in that kind of region. And so again, one issue is that because the atmosphere is warmer now than it was 50 years ago, it now holds more water vapor than it did 50 years ago, about 5 to 10% more. And so again, you get a storm coming through with that much more water vapor in the atmosphere, it drops that much more precipitation. And so that contributes to the flooding. And so it turns out this past winter of 2018 to 2019, it was the wettest winter ever recorded in the United States. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot more of these, you know, extreme precipitation events causing this, you know, significant flooding events. For California, where I live, I tend to focus on California a lot. And there was a really good new paper published in a journal, Nature Scientific Reports, that was looking at flooding in California, but taking into account a lot of different factors that can contribute to it. And so not just looking at, for example, sea level rise, which is one main contributor to flooding in California, but also they looked at changes in tides, changes in storms, you know, again, the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, erosion caused by flooding events, all these things that contributes are going to contribute more and more to flooding in California. And they said once we take all those factors into account, they estimated we're going to see over $150 billion of property, equating to more than 6% of California's GDP, and 600,000 people potentially impacted by this dynamic flooding, dynamic meaning you're accounting for all these different factors, by the end of the century. So again, this flooding, because we have more water vapor in the atmosphere, we have higher sea level rise, all these factors contributing to more and more flooding. And so there's in different regions, depending on which particular region that you're in, that can be a significant impact. And the Midwest is one area where they're really, right now, or at least just recently, were significantly impacted by worsening flooding. This was created by Robert Rode at the Berkeley Earth team. And it's how the distribution of temperatures over the planet, this is the global average temperature, has changed since we've recorded temperatures over the past, you know, since about the 1880s. And so you can kind of see it has this nice bell curve. And so, you know, you're seeing, you know, the y-axis is the percentage of the Earth's surface at a given temperature. And then the x-axis is that temperature anomaly, which is the difference from the average. So you can kind of see gradually that bell curve is shifting a little bit to the right as temperatures increase. Although in the 1900s, the curve pretty much stayed the same. It's kind of a very steep curve with a high peak, well, meaning that a lot of temperatures kind of in that similar range. And then as we get toward the end here, so you can see a pretty big change that now the curve is, not only is it shifted way over because temperatures are significantly warmer, about 1 degree Celsius warmer, but it's kind of shorter and fatter. So it's got these fat, we call them fat tails, especially on the right side. You can see it kind of dips further and further out to the right, which basically means we're seeing more and more extreme temperature events, or basically more and more of these heat waves as this distribution changes. And so, you know, heat waves is something that, I mean, we have to worry about for a lot of different regions. The Midwest is one. Again, the Southeast is another one. Here in California, we see a lot of heat waves. And so, you know, again, that's, you know, a pretty clear-cut impact of climate change as you get, or global warming, as you get higher temperatures, you're going to get more of these heat waves. Not just because the average is shifting, because we're also seeing more of these extreme events on the fat tail of the distribution of these like 2 and 3 degrees Celsius on average temperature differentiations from the average. So it's a very significant change that we're seeing. And of course, you know, the warmer we get, the more and the worse of these heat waves we're going to see. And for the Midwest, I mean, that's an area where agriculture is really important. And so seeing kind of these 1-2 punches of you're getting really bad heat waves, which is not good for crops. Then you're seeing a lot of flooding, which is really not good for crops. I mean, that's something that we seriously have to worry about in terms of, you know, getting enough agricultural production. Okay, so let's move to the Southwest, which, you know, here in California, we're technically considered part of the Southwest. And so this is kind of my favorite area to talk about. And in this area, wildfires and drought are two really big, serious impacts that we have to worry about. And so in California, wildfires have been a really big problem. This chart shows the 20 largest wildfires on record in California. And you can see the top 10 are in that green box there. And 8 of the top 10 have happened since 2007. So over the past 12 years or so, we've seen 8 of the top 10 biggest wildfires on record in California. And that second box is the Camp Fire, which just happened this past November. It was the deadliest and most destructive fire in California history. Actually, last year was a really bad one for extreme weather disasters in the United States. This is the list of the top five worst extreme weather events in the world in 2018. And you can say, the third one was Hurricane Florence in September. The second one was Hurricane Michael in October. And then the worst one was the Camp Fire in California in November. So the United States got hit by the three most expensive extreme weather disasters last year in a three consecutive month span. In total, they were almost $50 billion in costs and losses due to these three extreme weather events. So there you go. Hurricanes and wildfires are very, potentially very expensive and damaging and destructive weather events that climate change is clearly making worse. This is some data showing the change in area burned in California by wildfires each year. And so you can see there's a lot of variability. It goes up and down depending on the weather in a given year. But the dashed line there, that is the linear trend. So there's this long-term trend of wildfires kind of getting bigger and bigger and bigger on average over time. And you can see 2018 is the largest one on there. 2018 was the year with the most acreage burned on record in California. So it was a really bad year, and we've had a lot of those really bad wildfire years recently. And so the National Climate Assessment Report had a really good section on wildfires in the West, and they had this nice quote. So there's there's a lot of confusion about what is causing this increase in areas burned by wildfires. Some people of particular political persuasions will say, it's just because California is not doing adequate forest management, and if we would just manage our forests properly, then we wouldn't be seeing this increase in wildfires. That is incorrect, although forest management is certainly one factor contributing to it, because we did for a long time kind of do over too much fire suppression. Whenever there was a fire, we'd put the fire out as quickly as possible, and so there wasn't enough natural burning of the fuels that's needed to kind of keep the fuel load down so that wildfires don't burn out of control. So there is certainly an aspect, a contribution of forest management to that increase in wildfires, but that's not the only factor. And so in the Forest National Climate Assessment, they looked at all the different factors, and they had this nice quote in there. They said, climate change has led to an increase in the area burned by wildfire in the Western United States. Analyses estimate the area burned by wildfire from 1984 to 2015 was twice what would have burned had climate change not occurred. Furthermore, the area burned from 1916 to 2003 was more closely related to climate factors than to fire suppression, local fires management, or other non-climate factors. Climate change has driven the wildfire increase, particularly by drying forests and making them more susceptible to burning. So again, these other factors, fire suppression and fire management, those did play a role, but the single biggest role is associated with climate change. And they had this nice chart in this. This is from a paper that was published in 2016 that they grabbed and put into the National Climate Assessment Report, and it shows the cumulative area burned. So they're adding up the area burned by wildfires every year to the sum of the previous years, which is why it goes up every year. And so you can see the yellow line is the area that would have burned without climate change, and then the orange is the area, the additional area that burned because of climate change, because of temperatures getting higher and drying things out more. And so as I said in that quote, the area burned by wildfires is twice as much because of climate change as it would have been without climate change. So basically it doubled the area burned over the past 30 years or so. And there's been good research looking into what we can expect in the future. So this is from a paper published in 2011, looking at different scenarios and how much wildfire will burn in the acreage that will burn in California in these different scenarios. And so, for example, if we manage to stay within the Paris climate target of 2 degrees Celsius warming, we'll see about 20 to 30% increase in area burned over the next century. If we miss it and we get twice as much warming, we'll see about twice as much area burned, 40 to 70% on average statewide. The chart or the map on the right side there, that is in the higher scenario. If we miss the Paris target and we get to 4 degrees Celsius warming, that anything in orange is a doubling in the area burned by wildfires in a given year. And then as you get to red, it's like a tripling or quadrupling or more of the area burned in a given region. And so you can see in Northern California, which is actually close to where I live in the Central Valley there, but in Northern California, that's where you get all the concentration of the wildfires because that's where we have all the forested land. And so in Northern California, the wildfires are really serious concern that we're going to be seeing much, much more area burned, especially if we don't get global warming under control, which is why Jerry Hinkle and I have been doing this wildfire speaking tour. We're going around to these different parts of the state, mostly areas that have been impacted by wildfires, and giving this presentation with this information and saying, you know, here's how much it's going to get worse if we don't get global warming under control. Now let's pass the Energy Dividend Act. So wildfires are also related to drought, which is another big problem in California and other regions. Okay, so right around 2012, California started into this really long, severe drought. And so you're seeing the date on the top right change there, and then the colors on the map change, kind of the yellow to beige is kind of a moderate to mild drought. And then the red is a severe drought, and then the dark red is an exceptional drought. And so you can see in kind of this 2014, 2015, 2016 timeframe, a lot of the state was in this exceptional drought. This was actually a new category that the drought monitor people came up with because it was just the drought was so severe they had to come up with like a new extreme exceptional category. And so basically from 2012 to 2016, California was in a really, really severe drought, and that has contributed to wildfires because a lot of stuff is dried out, and it's also killed a lot of our trees in our forests, which creates a lot more fuel for wildfires when they go through. Research has shown that was the most intense drought from 2012 to 2016. That drought was the most intense drought California has seen in over 1,000 years. Scientists were able to go, they went around the state and drilled cores into oak trees, which live a long time, and they looked at the width of the tree rings, which tells you kind of back in time how much water there was available. And basically they concluded that drought from 2012 to 2016 was the worst in California in over 1,000 years. At the time, they also determined that there was low precipitation, but it wasn't record low precipitation. And so what made the difference and took that drought and made it a record-breaking drought was that we were having record high temperatures at the same time because of global warming. And so they concluded that global warming high temperatures made that drought about 25% worse than it would have otherwise been. And so it took a bad drought and made it into a record-breaking drought. And so one of the reasons we were getting relatively low precipitation was because there was this high-pressure ridge that was just sitting off California's coast for several years during that drought period. Daniel Swain, who is a meteorologist at UCLA, he called it the ridiculously resilient ridge because it was this high-pressure ridge that would not go away. It was just sitting. It was ridiculously resilient. It was sitting off California's coast. And because it was sitting there, when storms would come across the Pacific, instead of going into California, they would get pushed around California. And so all the rain would drop into, like, Alaska, Canada, northwestern United States. We weren't getting very much of the rain. And so things were drying out, which A, contributed to the drought, and B, contributed to wildfires. And so there's research suggesting this may be connected to the Arctic and the jet stream. And so the jet stream will normally go in a pretty straight line west to east across North America, as you can see on the left hand of this slide and left hand image. On the right hand image, sometimes it'll get these wavy patterns. These are called Rossby waves, named after the scientist Rossby. And so basically that's when the jet stream slows down. It's kind of like a river. When a river's going fast, it goes in this pretty straight line. And when the river slows down, it starts to meander and get a wavier, you know, meandering pattern. And so this seems to be related to the Arctic because one factor holding the jet stream in that straight line is the temperature difference between the Arctic and lower latitudes like North America. And so the Arctic is really cold, but it's warming really fast. And so that temperature difference is decreasing. And I'm going to go into that a little bit more. Because the temperature difference is decreasing, you're getting less of a force holding the jet stream in that straight line. And so you're getting more and more of these wavy meandering patterns. And when those patterns happen, weird stuff happens with the weather. As I said, the Arctic is really cold. It's actually, despite being cold, the fastest warming part of the planet. That is largely due to the fact that sea ice is melting really fast. So ice is white and reflective, and so when sunlight comes down and it hits the ice, it gets reflected back into space. But if ice melts and the ice is sitting on the ocean, instead of this reflective white surface, now you suddenly have this dark ocean surface, and sunlight comes down, it hits the dark ocean, it gets absorbed. And so that causes, because it absorbs more sunlight, it causes more warming, which causes more ice to melt, and because more ice is melting, it causes more sunlight to be absorbed, which causes more warming, and you get this kind of feedback loop. And so that's why the Arctic is warming particularly fast. And so since it's warming really fast, that temperature difference between the Arctic and the lower latitudes is decreasing, which is then decreasing that force holding the jet stream in a straight line. And so you get more of these wavy patterns, these Rossby waves. And there's been research showing that when you get these Rossby wave events, you get more extreme temperature and precipitation events. So that's basically because weather events tend to get stuck in between the waves in those kind of wavy pattern areas. So they get stuck in between the waves, and so they get stuck in one place. And so, for example, you get like a hot ridge kind of stuck in one place, and that causes a heat wave that's just stuck in this one place, so it makes the heat wave last that much longer. Or you get a storm stuck in one place, dropping all its precipitation in one place, and so you get more flooding in that particular area because that just happened to be where the weather pattern got stuck, because that's where the wave was in the jet stream. That's also related to, for example, the polar vortex. It tends to happen when you get this dip in jet stream, and that allows the cold Arctic air to kind of drop into the United States some winters, and so then you get these polar vortex events that everybody hates because they're super, super cold. So there's all these different kinds of weather events that seem to be connected to this wavy jet stream that seems to be connected to the Arctic warming super fast. Hey, this is a nice animation by a colleague of mine showing how quickly the amount of ice in the Arctic is decreasing. And so on this left ice cube is the volume of sea ice in the Arctic in 1979, and the right ice cube is how the volume changed every year after that. And then the red is the data in the back there. And so you can see it's been a really steep decline in the amount of ice in the Arctic over the past 30 to 40 years. We lost about 70% of the volume of ice in the Arctic over that 30, 40 year period. So it's been a really steep, severe decline, and you wouldn't really think that changes in Arctic sea ice would impact weather here in the United States. But, that's just how the climate works. Everything's kind of interconnected. And so this loss of this Arctic sea ice is actually impacting things like, polar vortex in the Midwest and potentially impacting droughts in California and, storms getting stuck in one place and dropping more rain and flooding in other regions. And so different regions are kind of impacted differently by this change in the jet stream. Okay, so the Northwest. The Northwest is impacted by these same impacts. They can get some fires, they're impacted by sea level rise along the coast, but a big one is the snowpack, because they have a lot of snow up there. And so I've got some data here. It's actually for the snowpack in California, because again I focus on California, but it's a similar story in the Northwest. So in California we have the Sierra Nevada snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and for California that's actually a really important supply of water for us. It kind of stores the water, and as the Sierra snowpack melts during the year, it refills our reservoirs, because we don't get any rain basically after April or so. And so our water comes from that melting snowpack. The problem is the snowpack is shrinking really fast. And so there have been a couple of studies that have concluded that for every 1 degree Celsius warming we get, we're going to lose about 20 to 25% of the Sierra snowpack. And we've already lost, we've already seen about 1 degree Celsius warming, so we've lost about 20% of the snowpack already. If we meet the Paris target, that's 2 degrees, we're going to have lost another 20 to 25%, so that's overall a loss of 40 to 50% of the Sierra snowpack if we meet the Paris target. And that's like, at this point, we're just trying to meet the Paris target, and that's going to be a really difficult task. And that's kind of almost the best case, is like losing 40 to 50% of the Sierra snowpack, which for us in California, that's a big problem that we have to learn to adapt to, is that, that shrinking water supply. So the reason specifically it's shrinking is twofold, because for one thing, as you have higher temperatures, more precipitation falls as rain and less as snow, and so it just doesn't build up as much during the year. And also because temperatures are higher, it melts faster, and so it doesn't last as long during the year. And so just those two factors, less snow, more rain, and melting faster, it just makes it shrink really fast. And so the same thing happens in the Northwest to their snow. It's a different speed that it's happening depending on the particular region, that particular snowpack. But that is a serious impact that, I mean, there's a lot of things that rely on the snowpack. You know, rivers, the fish need the water from the snowpack in the rivers. You have a lot of money tied in the winter snow sports industry. That's a big problem in the Sierra Nevadas. It's a really big problem in areas like Washington. They have a lot of winter snow sports that bring in a lot of revenue. And so, you know, that's a really significant economic impact that happens associated with climate change. So in the Northeast, we have a lot of these similar ones. We get flooding from storms, sea level rise. But a big one, and this is actually similar for the Northwest, is off the coast we have really important fisheries. And so fisheries are significantly adversely impacted by climate change because of a variety of different ways. You get warmer oceans, you get more acidic oceans because when you add more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, a lot of it goes into the ocean. And when the ocean absorbs carbon dioxide or absorbs carbon, it basically becomes, the pH decreases. It becomes more acidic or near less basic. So these things adversely impact fisheries, especially shellfish, but not just shellfish. And then in general, we're having a serious problem with extinctions everywhere, really, with all types of species. And so there's been a lot of concern over that we're headed towards what we call the sixth mass extinction. So there have been five mass extinction events in the past where something bad happened and it killed off most of the species on the planet. A lot of these are associated with, you know, large volcanic eruption events that have, you know, put a lot of particulates from volcanic eruptions in the atmosphere, which has caused rapid climate change, which have turned and has killed off a lot of species. One or two of them may have been associated with asteroid impacts that, again, have done similar things, caused rapid climate changes. And so the problem is right now we're also causing another rapid climate change, and species can only adapt so fast. And so on this chart, it's from a paper that was looking at this, and you can see that the dotted line at the bottom is kind of the background rate of how quickly species normally go extinct. It's cumulative, which is why it's going up every time. It's consistently going upward again because it's kind of adding up. This is how many total species we can expect to have gone extinct over this 100-year period. And then, you know, the colored lines show how quickly species are actually going extinct. And you can see the rate is much, much faster than we expect to see just based on normal background extinction rates. And some of that is related to climate change. Some of it is related to other human activities. It's not just down to climate change, but climate change is certainly one contributing factor to why so many species are going extinct so quickly. And so we're still relatively early on in this process, but it's something that we have to get off this path so that we don't end up causing another mass extinction event, because that is certainly a possibility if we continue on the current path. So it's not just a problem for the Northeast, but again, the Northeast has a particularly important economic ecosystems associated with their fisheries. And same thing for the Northwest, and a lot of coastal areas really rely on their fisheries for a lot of economic productivity. And the fishing community is in a lot of places very, very concerned about climate change because they are directly seeing the impacts on the fish and other marine species that they rely on. Okay, so let's talk about communicating impacts. So you can go to the Fourth National Climate Assessment Report. You just Google that, Fourth National Climate Assessment Report. And it's really accessible, and it's got some nice charts and nice summaries. It's very easy to read, and you can just go to the particular chapter associated with your particular region and look at and see what the science says about the impacts to your local region. And that's, as I said, that's a really useful thing to do because people don't realize it's already impacting us where we live right now. And this report really goes into detail, like here is how climate change is impacting your region here and now.
So first off, just a huge congratulations. And again, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through by region, all of the impacts that our country and our communities are currently facing.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
At this point, what we wanted to highlight was that there are additional resources on community. In fact, there's a whole local impacts section in the resources page for the directory, and we're adding two new ones this week. One of them is a state data map that the Climate Advocacy Lab put together and is continuing to stay updated. It's a wonderful feature that features a wealth of resources by state, of polling information, other impacts and resources, and additional ways that climate is already affecting your state, as well as climate signals. If anyone here on the line is aware of the work of Climate Nexus, a wonderful project that's really working hard on how to explore climate change and how it affects communities in terms of being able to be more effective in communicating those impacts, they have this new resource where essentially on the map you can see trending, current, and past significant events. They're grouped by colors and themes, and each of these has specific reports or articles or even news media coverage of these impacts. And you, as somebody that's being affected, can weave it into your own communication, whether it's a letter to the editor or your own conversation with your elected official. So let's talk specifically about how can you use all this? Again, this is clearly sobering information. And how can we as climate advocates that are concerned most effectively use this information in our own outreach? And one of the joys of the training page on local impacts and being able to highlight this research is it gives a wealth of recommendations. Now, I'm guessing all of you on the line, or at least many of you, have already done at least one, if not all of these. But just in case you haven't thought about the connections that you can use these local impacts on, social science continues to highlight the importance of making these connections up close and personal, not just the back, not just the faraway effects, but the backyard effects as well. And a lot of these resources are helping you contextualize local impacts in your own state and communities. So letters to the editor, meetings with members of Congress, municipal resolutions, being able to highlight that even in the language, in the whereases leading up to the adoption of that resolution. I know a lot of local cities have done that with their process for adopting municipal resolutions. Being able to highlight with local community leaders the impacts that they're also already facing economically, you know, from brewers to small business owners to construction and outdoor laborers. There's so many ways that you can tell that story with community leaders. The other great news is that we have finished a slide deck that is available for any CCL leader that would like to have a state-specific impact based on the work that the States at Risk report put out by Climate Central. And I'll put a link to that in the chat window in a little bit. But personalizing your presentations to make it more locally and really highlight and speak to what your actual community is facing is really key. And, again, highlighting in editorial board meetings as well as your social media. However, you can use your platform, whatever it might be, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, you name it, post and share stories and make that human connection possible. Humanize climate change so that it isn't just this far off and distant feeling threat, but something that people are already aware of, being impacted by, and working to address. Dana is available at dana1981@yahoo.com, and his Twitter handle is a very similar, @dana1981. Here's a link as well to the forums. Thank you for being here, and feel free to reach out to me. I know I put Dana's email, and I'll put mine as well, brett@citizensclimate.org. And obviously, we'll see you same time, same bad channel next week.
Good night.
All right.